Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
I don't hate it.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 368 for the week of August 16th, 2021. I am disappointing free barbecue David T. Cole, and I'm here with Stone Cold Sarah D. Bunting.
Stunner? I hardly even know her.
Sexy valet Tara Arietto.
I can also wrestle.
And chair shot recipient Joe Reed.
Ow!
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, he is the managing editor of Primetimer.com and the co-host of the This Had Oscar Bud podcast. Not Oscar Bud. The This Had Oscar Buzz podcast. You've heard him on this podcast many times. It is our old friend Joe Reed.
Smooth Joey!
Hi, guys. This Had Oscar Bud would actually be an interesting cross-section of Oscars and marijuana that I feel like we could maybe explore.
That's your Patreon. Mm-hmm.
A lot of Matthew McConaughey content.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Exactly. It's exactly it. Yep.
We're talking about heels, in which, in the small town of Duffy, Georgia, Jack Spade, played by Stephen Amell, runs the struggling Duffy Wrestling League, of which his late father, Tom, was the founder and star face, wrestling lingo for a good guy. Jack is a heel, which means bad guy, and in the series premiere is about to kick off a storyline where he battles his own brother Ace, Alexander Ludwig, the league's newest face. But Wild Bill Hancock, Chris Bauer, formerly his dad's longtime heel before he got called up to a National Wrestling League, is coming to town to scout Ace to join him. Will Jack support Ace progressing in his career or sabotage his shot to keep Ace and Duffy for the sake of Jack's storyline in Tarot Bang? The series creator is Michael Waldron, whose last TV project was Loki. Only the first episode of 8 has aired so far on Stars, but we got screeners for the first 4. We may obliquely make reference to events from later episodes. Let's do the Chen check-in. Joe, should our listeners watch Heels?
I'm on the fence leaning towards no, just because there's so much television.
Sarah.
I'm also on the fence. I think it does a lot of things well. I don't like to shit on Starz product because I feel like they do a lot of things well and more people should seek out their programming. But I'm out after 2, and I mean, I'm not going to recommend it either. I have specific reasons for that. There's like a couple of leading problems, but we can get into it.
Dave.
I don't hate it.
But no reason to keep watching it. So I agree with the consensus so far.
Yeah, I watched the first 4 because I wrote about it. And we'll link that in the show notes. Joe did too. I'll probably watch at least one more. I think it's fine. But I agree. Like, we're heading into fall. There are so many shows about to premiere that I like a lot better. Yeah. So I'm not against it, but I'm not super for it either.
Yeah.
Joe, you watched the WWF in your day. Did this even more scripted portrayal of men's wrestling work on you? Or did you spend the entire time wishing we were watching actresses in a certain other show we all love?
I mean, there's a lot of shows I watch that I wish I were watching GLOW instead. So, mm-hmm. Yes, I adored that show. I feel like I'm in good company there for people who adored that show.
Yep.
This is a show, I will give Heels credit in that it knows about the environment of which it has set its show. It is smart without feeling like it needs to like grind the gears to a halt to explain what this universe is. And they explain terms like face and heel, obviously, you referenced in the summary of the show. But things like kayfabe, which mm-hmm. is this sort of carny speak for essentially keeping up the gimmick of wrestling inside and outside the ring. You know, you're selling that the moves are real, but you're also outside the ring. And in like grand wrestling tradition, like the people who played the faces and the heels, like never were allowed to like interact where the public could see them because they had to keep up the facade that they hated each other. Right. And that's a thing that like in modern days, there's much more of an awareness on the fans' part that you're watching a show. I think the WWE probably doesn't keep up the facade outside of the ring that like these people aren't performers and that kind of thing. But I think in a small town, very sort of localized community that this takes place in, it would make a little bit more sense that they have to, like, these brothers who are, you know, opposing each other in the show are, you know, have to like keep up something of that. And obviously the show makes a lot of hay with the fact that like they have problems and they have conflict in their actual life. My friend Latoya Ferguson wrote about this show for Paste, I want to say, and she's talked about how the show has a little bit of an older fashioned sense of what the wrestling business kind of is and how wrestling comes across in a way that like it does write off a little bit to the fact that it's about a small town, sort of small indie promotion. But there were things like the fact that the fans so turned on Jack and Ace when they have their little like real life sort of spat in the ring. And like nowadays that would like get a lot of attention and that would probably be a big plus for this wrestling organization. And so in those ways, like it's very knowledgeable about the business, but it also seems to want to do like the interpersonal drama above all, which I guess it should because it's, you know, a TV show and it's not, you know, actual sport. But there are things like the fact that like oh, no, I'm going to forget her character's name, and that's too bad because she's so overlooked in the story. But Crystal, who is Ace's sort of valet in the show, and she really wants to, like, she wants to be a wrestler herself. And Mary McCormick's character keeps telling her, like, get out of the locker room and you don't belong here. But, like, these days, women's wrestling is huge to the point of, like, being more popular in many ways and more accomplished than what the men's wrestling in the WWE is at this point. So, like, that to me felt a little backwards.
I didn't buy that part of it at all. Yeah, that they kept being like, you know, they're in a whatever brawl. She acquits herself like an actual brawl in a bar. She acquits herself nicely and they're all like, damn, like what year is it? I mean,
well, and also it does that thing that wrestling shows and a lot of times even action movies just can't resist, which is she pulls off a full on like wrestling move where it's called a Frankensteiner in wrestling, where it's like you jump up and you like grab their head between your legs and then you flip them over their head. And it's like, but you've already gone to such pains to talk about how this is choreographed in the ring. That move doesn't happen unless the other person is going along right with you. So yeah, now yeah. I have this happen at a bar brawl and have it seem like totally real and spontaneous. I'm like, what's going on here? What's that?
Yeah, there's a weird disconnect with this show that where it's positioning wrestling as theater versus something that you're supposed to think is real, and the way like that sort of the mouth of the South's Elizabeth type of character is portrayed feels like this show should have been a period piece, but that they didn't do that because they didn't want to invite yet more comparisons to GLOW. Like this feels like the small town feel of it, the way that this is a family business. It all feels like wrestling 30 years ago or so, or 40 years ago. Even like the Wild Bill character, like that guy feels like he's right out of the 80s as well. Like I feel like this show would have made a lot more sense in the 80s and then could have been more playful because of it. And that's the other problem, is that this show's kind of a downer for such like for the anchor being such a ridiculous form of entertainment and so brash and loud. The show is very subdued and muted, and it feels at odds with itself. If they could have actually had fun with the 80s setting instead of perhaps being a little scared to do that because GLOW happened a couple of years ago, probably would have been more fun.
Yeah, that more fun is my main knock on it. Like, it's not as fun as it should be. The only scenes that I thought were really noteworthy and memorable were the ones where Wild Bill is in, the Chris Bauer character, like, really cutting loose and being completely crazy. Like, I just love seeing him get to do this after roles, you know, where he, in The Wire or For All Mankind or...
Right. The consummate detective, like, the third dudes. Detective in a thing. Yeah.
Sort of a related question to my initial one. We'll start with Joe. Was it as homoerotic as you would want it to be? And let me just say, starting from the point of like the two main guys are brothers, you're already like, come on. Now when I'm like watching you fight, I can't be like, kiss, because it's gross.
Exactly. Exactly. like taking nothing away. Stephen Amell is an incredibly handsome man. Alexander sure. Ludwig is super hot. Like, and as an actor, I like really enjoy. He was in a movie called The Final Girls, a sort of horror comedy called The Final Girls that was actually really good. I really liked him in that. And I guess he's also in, is it Vikings? Yeah. One of those yeah. Spartacus? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of those.
You know, one of those shows, yes. But, like, he's super hot. Like, you see his butt a few times in the four episodes that I watched. Like, I'm not complaining about that.
Sure.
I could always do with more homoeroticism. There's nothing in the... Like, throw me a supporting character who's, like, quietly gay or something. Yeah. Just, like, give me something. Like,
or
nothing.
Loudly gay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Sarah,
right.
Same question, Sarah. Yeah.
I mean, one of my main problems is with Ace, the Ludwig character. Like, mm-hmm. The performance, I guess, is fine. But I don't think the show understands how this character is coming off. And I don't think the show has decided what it wants us to think of him or like what side yeah. it wants him to be on. And I feel like bets are being hedged, but in the wrong direction. Like there are a number of scenes where he's behaving so gratuitously based on yes. what we've already been told, like yes. that being a fattest asshat to the girl at the convenience store is like,
yeah, totally miscalibrated that scene.
That's exactly the right way to put it. And then, you know, I think the show tries to manipulate like beyond, like it doesn't stay in its lane in terms of the manipulation that it's earned.
Yeah.
So at the end of the first episode, like there's dropped popcorn and then silence in yeah. the dome.
Yeah.
And then he's crying and it's a montage. Like take three of these things off. And
yeah.
also don't make him like, are we supposed to feel sorry for him? Like, good. He's been a twat the whole episode. Like,
right.
let him cry. So that's a problem. There are conversations that never mind, like sort of locating people in the world of pro wrestling, like that stuff. I thought they did pretty elegantly, but there are conversations that I just am not. But buying, like, I don't buy that we're at this place in these brothers' relationship right now. I don't understand why there always has to be this biblical agita
yeah.
between brothers in TV shows. Like, can't they just fucking get along? Like, I know conflict makes your story, but give me a break. I don't believe that Willie, the Mary McCormack character, would be this dismissive in these ways of Crystal.
Right.
To the point of calling her Cheryl, which I almost just did myself. Like, there are just things in here that are like, I felt like they were trying to reach in and pluck a nose hair to get me to cry a couple times. And I was like, I well, resent this.
Yeah.
You're focusing on the wrong stuff. Like that one teeny scene where the luchador like bolts, they're like trying to fuck in the locker room. He bolts out and he's like, let me know when you're done so I can finish my poo. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, bottle episode about that guy just like stuck in the stall like, God damn it, this guy. It's trying too hard to be other shows that I would rather just go watch instead, I think would be my capsule yeah. review, and quit it with the Friday Night Lights music cues.
The music is so, so heavily applied.
It's so close.
Well, yeah. two things. I will say they do end up explaining like what the deal is with the brothers and their dad. But I think, as we've been saying about a lot of shows lately, like it just needs to get there faster. Like there's a yeah. there's a pacing problem. But to the Friday Night Lights point, Dave, play the clip that I got.
I don't get it.
I will walk in the shore to find you, to find
Yeah. When I thought the cold open was good, and then we get to that theme song, and it's like, oh no, it thinks it's Friday Night Lights, and Joe and I both independently made that, that comparison. It's kind of really inevitable does. In our it,
and then
writing
Mrs.
about
Jack
it.
Is obviously supposed to be Tammy Taylor. Like she's, right. I feel like she's such a Mary Sue, and a lot of the ways that small town life is framed, like I think that I don't mind seeing small town life on TV, but I think there's this instinct to like ennoble it beyond what it can take in a community of a few thousand people that you're definitely seeing here. Like the sort of idea that the internet is selectively applied to communicate information among the characters only, and then they have kind of no concept of how the world actually works is like, it's like they have satellite.
Yeah.
Like, let's not be this condescending and have nobody have any bad qualities. And like,
there's some stuff down the line and in some of the later episodes with Stacy, who is Jack's wife, and Jack's mother, who is, I should note, because I'm soap opera guy, she's Alice Barrett from Another World, who I loved when I was growing up. But talking, where like Stacy sort of bristles against this this notion of becoming sort of the kind of wrestling wife that Jack's mother was and sort of lived her life, you know, washing wrestling tights and sort of making sure that, you know, everything was right for that. And then this woman now whose husband is dead is sort of finding herself kind of alone with her anger about things. And that's pretty good. But again, like, if that's counterpoint to something more lively and fun, then I think it probably works even better. And right now it's just sort of like, of a piece with all this kind of glum business.
Or make it about that. Like, white sport man pain. We're all set.
Right.
Yeah.
Before we leave, I do want to say I have to make a correction. I'm sure from the time people started listening to now, they've already gone on Twitter to correct me. That's fine. I understand. But I said Mouth of the South's Elizabeth, but I should have said Macho Man's Elizabeth up at the top. But I just want to correct myself. Because I did watch wrestling at the time. I went to Cops Coliseum in Hamilton. I saw the Battle Royale. I saw the Iron Sheik win it all. I was there. I should know what I'm talking about, but I made that mistake, and I want to apologize for it. Why it's time to go around the dial. Our first stop is with Tara.
Hi.
My
highbrow pick this week is Reservation Dogs. This is a new FX on Hulu. So dumb. Just be Hulu. Show that drops new episodes on Mondays. It's co-created by Sterling Harjo and Taika Waititi and is notable for having an all-Indigenous writing staff, slate of directors, and cast. So here's the show. In a reservation village in Oklahoma, Bear, Alora Dannon, like the baby in Willow, Willie, Jack, and Cheese are the titular reservation dogs, a teen gang of sorts who run scams and small-scale heists in order to raise money to move to California as soon as they can. For example, the pilot opens on them stealing a chip truck while the driver is inside delivering an order, and then they sell the truck to local meth heads and sell the chips for 50 cents a bag on Bear's front yard. And they have to pull away so fast, like the ramp is still dragging behind, sparking, like they drive right by a cop, does not notice. They also used to have a fifth friend who ran with them, Daniel, but we meet the kids around the first anniversary of his death. And as of the second episode and the third, which we've now watched, we still don't know how he died. And the kids were all unknown to me, but other cast members include Zahn McLarnon from Fargo and Westworld. Bobby Lee is also very funny in the second episode as the clinic doctor. He comes in to look at Bear. Bear's just been wrecked by the other rival teen gang and is like, aren't you the eye doctor? And Dr. Kang says, I'm the everything doctor. Eyes, guts, assholes. After Bear hopefully says he probably shouldn't fight anymore because of his nose, right? Dr. Kang's like, yeah, fight all you want. And he also examines Alora Dannon, who has a stomach ache, asking her what she eats every day. Obviously, a staple of her diet are the Flaming Flamers chips that they jacked. And he asks how many bags a day she eats. She says one, and he just stares at her. And then she goes, tea, meaning 10. There's also a moderate mystical element in the form of a 19th century indigenous warrior who appears when Bear's cognition is compromised, like when he gets knocked out after the fight. And this guy talks to him about his life, but the warrior isn't anyone noteworthy. He's just a guy, and his advice is not really very insightful. And so I won't say the reservation is another character, but the show has a very strong sense of place. The vibe reminds me most of Atlanta. and that it revolves around characters who are making dumb decisions they don't think through, dumb yet funny, surrounded by other secondary and tertiary characters whose quirks proceed directly from where they're from. And the difference is the heedless central characters here are actual teenagers, not marginally functional adults. And one of the knocks on The White Lotus that I read on Vox this week, we'll link to it, is that the Native Hawaiian characters in that show are kind of used as props in stereotypical ways and contexts. And I think that comes from having a well-meaning white writer writing and directing it. In this case, the identities of all the characters and the portrayal of their town feel very authentic and lived in. And this was a show I started to watch alone and then thought, okay, Dave might also like this. And he does. Dave, your thoughts on Reservation Dogs?
Yeah, it's good. It's just like the perfect mix of drama and comedy in this format. And I would say I agree. It did remind me of Atlanta, talking about contemporary shows. But I would sprinkle in like a little Northern Exposure across that. It has the sort of like quirky side characters that are always a joy to see. And they sort of pop in and out of episodes.
Solid rec.
It's really good, and it's a shame it's not on actual
TV. Yeah.
I know like all TV is heading that way, but there's still a certain sort of value attached to that. Yeah. And I feel like this show deserves more exposure and would have been nice if it had that sort of real TV bump.
Yep, agree. So briefly, since I talked about it when it premiered and it was the show I was most looking forward to this summer, I already mentioned it. The White Lotus just ended on Sunday. What a show. I'm glad it's coming back for a second season. Dave Chen of Chen Check-In fame had me on his Patreon this week to talk about the season. We spoil everything, so don't listen if you haven't watched yet. We'll link it in the show notes. It's Patreon, so you have to support him to hear it, but you should. He does fun stuff on that feed all the time. Speaking of going on vacation to a weird island, I also watched the premiere of Fox's Fantasy Island sequel. By the time you hear this, the first two will have aired, although I have not watched the second one yet. So the original Mr. Rourke has died. But his grandniece, Elena Rourke, played by Rosalind Sanchez from Devious Maids, is now running the resort, making people's fantasies come true in unexpected, sometimes very dark ways. In the pilot, the first guest we meet is Christine, played by the great Bellamy Young from Scandal. That name, by the way, seems like not an accident. She's a local morning news anchor in Arizona who's recovering after having an on-camera meltdown. But the new weatherman bringing a giant box of donuts to the set, which is triggering for her because she's compulsive about her weight. Her fantasy is to spend her week on the island eating whatever she wants and not gaining weight. And Elena's like, I can give you literally anything and you want a buffet. And she's like, yes. So first she gets a single truffle that keeps regenerating every time she eats it. And then they absolutely fill her room with dishes of food. Most of it is the kind of indulgent stuff you would expect. But I also saw a plate of asparagus. And when I tweeted about this, someone was like, hollandaise sauce, get the fuck out of here. Put the hollandaise on Eggs Benedict. If I see one vegetable in my fantasy food suite, I am demanding a full refund on the spot. Anyway, as I tweeted, I should go into that room and wonder if there is a bed under the mac and cheese. Like, that's what I'm looking for.
It
anyway.
Is the bed.
Sure.
Extra large tray and a pillow. Love it.
So as Christine's storyline continues, we find out her issues with food and self-denial aren't just because she is a woman living in patriarchy and working in a field where viewers will comment on her weight if it changes in any way, but because when she was a kid, her mother married a terrible shithead and he was constantly critical of her looks. They show her as a kid with like jacked up teeth. And this is like, they're like Halloween store teeth they put on this poor child. Anyway. Her mother died of cancer and left her with this guy who continued to make her feel insecure. And then Christine's about to sit down to another meal when her stepfather is there. And she confronts him about his emotional abuse, but not really conclusively. And then later shows up on the beach for a pig roast. But the pig is her stepfather roasting on a spit. And we don't see her eat him to settle her issues with him. But it's strongly implied that she did. And you know what? If that helps you get to peace, eating the tormentor that made your life hell, I support it. The other guest is a woman named...
Can we please throw in a drop here that's just like Scott Tenorman? Ha, 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 I made you eat your parents. Like, I didn't want to make more work for Dave, but like...
So the other guest is a woman named Ruby. She's there with her husband, Mel. Ruby has terminal cancer. We don't know what exactly, but she's walking with a cane. Her fantasy is to dance like she did when she was young, because Elena makes it clear she can't cure her cancer. But there is something she can do, which turns out to be direct the two of them to a waterfall that when they get in subtracts like 30, 40 years from their age. Ruby is loving her new old knees, takes them out for a run, which is when she meets a sexy lady named Isla. as in the Spanish word for island. I don't get it. Turns out Ruby was queer, but didn't feel she was able to live as her true self in her youth, though she's also been happy in her marriage with Mel. They have kids and grandkids. We see them having lots of sex when they first turn young. But then Mel sees Isla giving Ruby a tattoo on her back in the middle of a beach dance they go to one night. Ruby stroking her leg. Long story short, when it's time to go, Elena tells Ruby she can stay on the island and be young and healthy and hot and gay, or go back to her life with her husband and die, basically. Mel selflessly tells her to stay since he's about to lose her one way or another. And as Ruby is seeing him off, we see the sketchy tattoo fill in with like a spirally design on her back. Because guess what? She's the new tattoo. It airs on Tuesdays. It has extremely Saturday night energy, just like the original, which is why it's fun that Fox is re-airing it that night. Not that it really matters in the age of streaming, but watch it on Saturdays with a big bowl of popcorn and a milkshake like you're babysitting in 1981. Also, if you have Stars, maybe you do if you're watching Heels, the Blumhouse movie that came out last year, their Fantasy Island movie, is still streaming there. It's very different, much more horror-y, but it is also fun. So I also, side recommendation for that.
Wait, so hang on. This person can create a self-regenerating truffle, but can't cure cancer?
Yes!
Okay.
Priorities, Dave, priorities.
It seems like they've mastered molecular manipulation so that, you know, it's just a matter of what molecules you want to move out of a cancerous cell.
Yeah.
But all their molecule manipulation is truffle-based.
But then you have no, like, everybody just comes to take the cure and then leave, and it's not.
I think she can. She just won't.
That She's could be.
That could also be.
All her tumors are now ganache truffles, so maybe that's what it does, is it turns, that's where the truffles come
Who's
from.
Who's bankrolling Fantasy Island? Oh, it's Big Pharma. Ba-ba-bum.
That's a different movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, for my plug, I reviewed the first 5 episodes of the final season of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. That is at vanityfair.com, and we will link that in the show notes as well.
Mr. Joe Reed, what do you got?
So I have come here to talk about Big Brother. Nobody go anywhere. Lock the doors. I am honestly for real recommending Big Brother in the summer of 2021. Okay, so questions as to why I never stopped watching Big Brother, I don't need to answer at this time. I feel like
that's nobody's business.
I'm going to plead that. That's right. You mind your business. Big Brother knows why. It had gotten really, really bad, though, in recent years, particularly when it came to things like the house guests being incredibly racist and like alienating of the house guests of color. And it seemed like anytime the show had tried to like make small little gains and like, now we're going to cast like 4 or 5 people of color in the season. And it's just like, no, they're just all going to be alienated by the like big, dumb, boring white people who like ran roughshod over last season, which like, it was in the middle of the pandemic, and I really needed some, like, fun, like, carefree television to watch, and it was a Big Brother All-Star season, and I was looking forward to it, and it was awful. So, cut to this season, though, and finally, somebody at some point had enough, and a casting director, I believe, was let go, and CBS instituted a mandate for its reality shows that it would cast its shows, including Survivor and Big Brother, and presumably The Amazing Race, if we're ever able to have an Amazing Race again in this global travel situation, that the casts would be 50% people of color. And almost, like, pretty much immediately, it has reaped really, really good rewards on Big Brother. This season is, not only did they cast 50% people of color, but they also seem to just have a better sense of casting people who enjoy the actual machinations and gamesmanship of Big Brother, rather than just want to like be on, you know, the LA backlot version of F-Boy Island for a summer. Like, these people are kind, they're like, they're gamers, they're smart. Even the like even the dumb bros, even the like bimbo looking guys who just like have a nice head of hair and are chiseled, are like, they're gamers, which is kind of cool. But also, like, just sort of circumstantially, and maybe not circumstantially, the alliance that is dominating this season so far is called The Cookout, and it's like all 6 Black cast members have all banded together, and they have been running this house for the last 5 weeks. They've been like, the first 5 people eliminated have all been white people. 4 of them are like, the 4 white men are like off of the show. It's like, it's kind of just like, it feels like cosmic retribution for the show, but it also, it's so satisfying because it's being accomplished by really, really smart, like, alliance work. And the oldest person in this cast, which I expressed horror at in the first episode, is 40 years old, which is exactly how I am. So now I've reached the token old cast member in a reality show portion of my life. But her name is Tiffany, and she rules, and she's been, like, running this house, and it's been so satisfying. And if you've been, like, out on Big Brother because it's, like, grossed you out, because the people are stupid and it's really depressing to watch, like, you know, white people gang up on people of color, it's been not that way this season, and it's been really satisfying. And for as much as I am, like, reticent to give a whole lot of, like, good on you credit for a show that is still hosted by Julie Chen Moonves, who has changed her television moniker to Moonves after her husband was accused of sexual harassment and predatory behavior. Yes. So definitely not a favorite of that. But kudos to Big Brother for actually being a show that is fun to watch again at the very least. So I will say that. If you are in any way curious, duck your head back in and take a look.
Nice.
For my plugs, find me on primetimer.com. I'm writing a lot of Emmy preview stuff leading up to next month's Emmy Awards. If you are interested in the smooth Joey Apollo portion of my life, I'm sort of handicapping the major categories there. I also had a piece go up this past week looking back at the episode of Celebrity Jeopardy where Shark Tank's Kevin O'Leary shows up and like embarrasses the fuck out of himself. It's so satisfying to watch big rich dum-dums show up on Jeopardy and just totally show their ass. So like that was super fun. You can also listen to my podcast, This Had Oscar Buzz, where my co-host Chris File and I talk about movies that had Oscar aspirations that it didn't work out. Our most recent episode that went up as of this recording yesterday, we talked about the movie Stepmom with our guest Christina Tucker. Woo! And it was a super, super fun conversation that sort of went in all different directions, as is our custom. I found the house that they filmed it at in Nyack, and it's big and giant, and I want to have all of us pool our money together and go look at it. It's basically where I'm at with that. So
send us a prospectus. I'm listening.
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Okay, so Animal Kingdom is back. I feel like this did not get promoted, like, hardly at all, since I was one of four people who was watching it anyway. Hey, John Ramos. And I didn't realize it, so I'm only catching up now. And I might bail if they can't figure out what to do with Flashback Janine. I said this in my write-up of the fourth season finale for Primetimer.com, which happened 2 years ago. I had been complaining about Layla George's performance as old Janine throughout that season, but whereas Ellen Barkin was able to give Smurf competent, effective anti-hero with her performance, Layla George is just serving bratty mean girl still. This is a problem I had with the Ace character and performance in Heels as well. Like, it's a fine line, and I'm not blaming the performers in either case for not being able to fill in gaps the writers don't seem to understand are there. But the problem in this case is that Animal Kingdom is trying to show us how Janine became Smurf. And it seems to lack any real plan for doing that, save a bunch of period costuming and expensive diegetic music cues to locate us in time. We've never gotten the impression in the present that Smurf was anything but a ruthlessly organized executive gangster. But with every year the Flashback show passing, and we've now jumped ahead about 7 years since last season, it makes less sense that Flashback Janine is still a hand-to-mouth fun mom grifter who's giving her kids milkshake with booze in them and has poor impulse control. Like, never mind getting to the fireworks factory, we're also going to need to understand how she ended up running it or whether she even knows what fireworks are. She made a fortune with little to no law enforcement interference, particularly when a cop in the first episodes of this season explicitly says, after he's gotten paid off to ignore a gunfight, that shit was not like this when Smurf was running things. Like, guys, you need to start moving these characters closer to each other. And Layla George she can't do much. Like, she's very pretty, but she just can't do much with this. We also have some issues with Pope. I'm not trying to draw the lightning of John Ramos's wrath here, because Sean Hitosi is giving a hell of a performance with whatever this is supposed to be at any given time. But now the flashbacks want to overdetermine Pope's character based on what we're clearly supposed to see as a neurodivergent situation of some sort, which is fine. But you don't have to show him organizing things by color in every single scene the child is in. Once would do it. Zero would do it even better. There's also no reason this couldn't have been some kind of attachment disorder or childhood post-trauma, like I think we all assumed it was. I am not a doctor. I do not play one on or near TV. But can't neurodivergent characters just exist? Can't scripted persons just have compulsions and Freudian shit that isn't delineated? This show is full of hotties. It's still pretty good at conceiving and executing heist set pieces. I'm not like fatally angry at it. It's nice to see Nick Stahl getting work. There's a running gag with Craig and electric scooters that I'm enjoying because my dog, Bear, as often heard on this podcast, unfortunately, sorry, has a scooter vendetta, which is often why he's barking at any given time. And I, too, want to hurl them into the sea, if only to stop him yapping his head off. But in a lot of ways, Animal Kingdom seems like it's still in over its head with the killing off of its primary both hero and villain. And it is frustrating given that they had, again, 2 years like enforceably to figure their shit out, how little they did to do that. If you would like, you can find the mere tip of my season 4 Animal Kingdom complaint berg at Primetimer. It is linked in the show notes. And if you would like to buy slightly better written books about real crimes happening in Southern California, I've got a link for that too. I've got a whole bookshop for that. It's called Exhibit B, and there's a link in the show notes. I hope that you will visit.
I'm going to talk about What If Ellipsis? Question mark from Disney Plus, the new Marvel animated show talking about what ifs, alt history, etc. in the Marvel universe, building off the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So it's an animated show about the movies, kind of. And we watched the first episode, and I thought it was sort of an odd choice for the first episode because, like, the question it poses is basically all you get in the episode, and that is, what if Peggy Carter was the one to become Captain Country? So she becomes Captain Britain instead of Steve Rogers being Captain America.
Well, they just call her Captain Carter. I don't even think it's clear that she's Captain Britain.
Right. There is a Captain Britain in the comics, which is why my brain went there.
Right.
And that's the gist of where it ends, too. The episode ends where the first Captain America movie ends, with Peggy Carter being the one that wakes up in the future with Nick Fury there saying, now we're going to do some stuff. And the middle part.
Perfect impression.
Thank you. The middle part, you know, has different action. But the what ifiness of it was very non-what ify. It was just like.
Yeah, it was pretty simple.
There was no real difference between the cause and effect stuff. And like the middle was fine. The animation is gorgeous. They really nailed down a problem with that style of animation, which is the dynamic shadows for that sort of thing. There's been a lot of precursors to this way of doing animation where the shadows are just like one glob of 10% black, and it's never really on the right parts of the face because it's all just, they don't take care with the math of it. This does a good job there, so I was happy with that. The voice acting is a real mixed bag. Some people are in the studio to be on this Marvel project, and some are just reading a script, and they don't know what the scene is or something. There's a disconnect for a lot of the performances between what's going on screen and how much they're putting into their voice work.
Sebastian Stan was especially half-assed, I thought.
Everything to do with that was half-assed because I didn't realize that was supposed to be him for a little bit because the character model is off for him. It didn't really look like him. So I feel like this show had a more fanciful reimagining of the scenarios it's posing. It could actually be quite entertaining. Like, the problem with this first episode is you are given free rein and this is the safe choice that you have made. Mm. Boo.
And it feels like, knowing from the other episodes that they're doing, that it's at least going in more sort of spidery directions where, like, different characters are meeting other characters from different movies. And like, that to me seems like the potential at play here with a show like this. And maybe it'll be cooler in those episodes.
Tara, thoughts on slash fiction generated
by... Yeah, I'm happy for the community of tiny little guys who are into Bing Strong Ladies, because they all just signed up for Disney Plus to watch this episode over and over and over again.
That said, I would give my left nut to write for a Star Wars What If, because I think I would be really good at that. My first episode would be, what if Kylo Ren wasn't such a bitch? And that would be the best episode.
Also, you don't need your left nut. Let's be real.
On the next Extra Extra Hot Great, let's watch the Christmas episode of the Finelli Boys. Boy,
sorry.
What a ride. What a ride that was. That's available to our patrons this Friday at any level. Enjoy that. And then right here next week on EHG Prime, it is Netflix, The Chair. Yes, it's another TV show called The Chair. It's not that one chair. And it's not the other chair. This is like a third chair we've had this decade with our good friend, Bobby Krutt.
I was all of history's great acting robots. Acting Unit 0.8, Thespomat, David Duchovny.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from David Ellis Dickerson. It is called Rigid Air Vehicles. We are not totally sure why. We're
we
sure
have no
he will
idea
let us
why
know.
It's called that.
Here's what David writes. The good news is you are being given the power to create a TV show. The bad news is that it must star David Duchovny and January Jones. What's the show about? Who else is in it? And how do you work around the fact that the lead actors cannot actually express things like learning and growing? Parenthetically, he adds, I will allow substitutions if you'd rather work with Joel Kinnaman, for example, but you must always replace your leads with other actors who do not react to things, not a wooden flailer like Elizabeth Berkley. Shots fired all around.
Ouch.
Oh, boy. Okay.
So I love the personal prejudice that underlies this prompt, and I'm going to meet David on his terms, even though I kind of love January Jones. She's one of the many actresses.
I was
going to
say that, too.
She's one of many actresses, I'm sure you're going to say this, too, whose presence on Instagram is enjoyably chaotic, and she deserves our respect for that reason, if nothing else. Is her range small? Sure. I see his point. I have softened a lot on Duchovny over the years. Also, by the way, he's in The Chair, which we'll be talking about next week, so we'll be able to report on how good or bad he is these days. But okay, Duchovny and Jones together at last. What kind of story would their extremely low energy performance style serve? What kinds of people need to not react? Professional poker players. Jones is Alice Waverly. Duchovny is Joshua King. They are on the same circuit, so we see them in games with players who rotate in and out. Here's where you set up people like Elton John and Stephen Sondheim to complete their egots in extremely cynical ways. When they're not at the table, Alice and Joshua live uneasily with each other as their marriage teeters on the brink of collapse. But because they are both very aloof by nature, the expectation is that neither of them will actually push it over the edge, and they'll continue on until one of them dies quietly. Joe.
So, Tara, our minds are oddly in sync on this. And honestly, like, I should not be surprised. So, yes, in addition to reflecting your caveat at the beginning that, like, justice for January Jones, but I will take this prompt on its merits. So in the tradition of something like The Queen's Gambit, but also with the knowledge that we have had a feature film about the sport of tag, I am proposing a four-part streaming miniseries called Staring Contest, and it is about with the premise that staring contests have become like a thing that are televised on like ESPN 12 or whatever, and after cornhole,
dodgeball movie.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Basically, yes, and
the Ocho.
Duchovny and January Jones are a divorced couple who met and fell in love while traveling in the esoteric and niche popular sport of staring contests. And so now when we meet them at the beginning of the series, they are sort of acrimoniously divorced, but he's retired, but she's still a pretty big sort of superstar in the staring contest.
Super stare.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so they get the news that like whatever NBC knockoff, they're deciding to, you know, SchmenBC in this universe has decided to air a like four-night event that is a staring contest 2021. And for their big, centerpiece, they want to have a rematch between divorced superstars January Jones and David Duchovny. I haven't named them, so think of whatever. Bill and Sally. And so Duchovny's manager, yep, I did say played by...
First draft.
Yeah.
That's good pick.
Yep. No, the twist is she's Bill and he's Sally.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Wilhelmina, Bill, Anderson.
And, oh, God. Yeah,
exactly. Salvatore.
Salvatore. that's right. Okay. And Sal's manager, played by Ada Turturro, informs him that there's big money to be made if he... rejoins if he signs up for this. And so the four-part series is all leading up to this big matchup between them, and I won't spoil who wins, but it'll be quite exciting. So that's what I got.
Spectacular. Sarah.
The bad news is I didn't exactly follow the brief on this, but I hope old David Ellis will forgive me. The good news is once I thought of history's greatest acting robot and the Ice Queen of Austining, New York, judging a revival of Last Comic Standing, I couldn't stop thinking about it and wanting it to happen. Talk about a great weird lane for not reacting to things. Just I'm picturing them at the judges table at either end of it with, like, I don't know, like a different guest judge in the center every week. But like past judge of this show, Brandi Brown, in the middle, just like despairing of both of them and trying to like get out. And she can't like leave. And they're both just sitting there unblinking, staring contest. And doing riffs on their unresponsiveness, and like occasionally she pokes Duchovny with a hat pin to see if anything even happens. I thought of it, and then I thought of them like doing a live action reenactment of those scenes on Space Ghost where they just cut to him and he's just like frozen. It's like a still. They don't even animate it because they don't have to. I am not touching Kinnaman, given recent revelations, but this would also work with history's rapiest bowl of oatmeal, I suppose. Now I just really want them to judge something where we're used to like a lot of animation at the judges' table, or like people standing up and applauding. And it's like those two, and then Paula Abdul in the middle being like, "Where am I? Help!" Dave.
I have two. One is just a straight live action remake of an animated product. It is them as these two characters.
Morning, Ralph. Morning, Sam. Have a good day, Ralph. Thanks, Sam.
Oh, God.
That's it. They just play that. They won't tax him. They just have to say hello, goodbye, and then, yeah, like, you know, punch each other once in a while.
Roll down the occasional hill while dressed as a sheep.
Exactly.
Sure.
My actual answer, in the tradition of Voyagers and Quantum Leap, comes Impassionate History Correction Show. Proving exactly why David Duchovny is history's greatest acting robot. He is playing Correctron Alpha 10,000, a superpowered robot computer who scours the timeline for disruptive ripples in history that need to be corrected. His catchphrase is execute program. Jandery Jones is Miss Jones, you know, because it's just easier that way. A field agent for the Temporal Integrity Mission, or TIM, didn't quite get there, who is sent through time to do the footwork necessary to fix history. This usually involves animal tricks because the show creator loved the circus and wrote this into Miss Jones' backstory. So a lot of solutions involve training animals to do tricks to get tasks done that will somehow fix history. And I feel like that works with her because she just has to like shout at an animal, much in the way like when she, all her scenes in Mad Men at Home were shouting at kids. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the same energy, but for a show about correcting history. This show co-stars David Caruso as Time Blore, Finn Jones as the voice of Explainator, and finally Cobra Kai's Mary Mouser as Girl.
Love it.
It is time for The Canon, presenting this week our good friend Joe Reed. Take it away, Joe.
Thank you. So I am presenting a show that you guys covered on this program fairly recently. It's a pretty new show, but I easily probably one of my favorite shows of the pandemic era, and it came at a time that I very much needed it. So I wanted to sing the praises of my favorite episode of the first season of Girls 5 Eva. It is season 1, episode 6, titled Cease and Desist, written by Matt Whitaker. I did not write down who directed it, so apologies.
Kimmy Gatewood from Glow.
Oh, fantastic.
One of the biddies.
Oh, fantastic. Even better. All right. So at the risk of succumbing to recency bias, I'm bringing to the table my canon presentation for this episode. I'm going to lean on the caveat that time has operated differently during the pandemic and just say that the show, as I said, came at a time when I deeply needed something fun and fizzy and joke dense that was chock full of actresses that I loved. And this one very much hit the spot. I had a few great options for this first season, including the third episode, which featured the song New York Lonely Boy, which has taken up permanent residence in the back of my brain. But the episode that I chose, Cease and Desist, was the one that most blew me away with its insight and its comedy. So the plot for this episode is fairly simple. Summer, played by Busy Phillips, has found the group its first headlining gig of their comeback, an early aughts-themed pride party called Y2Gay. The girls plan to use the gig as an opportunity to debut their new single, Four Stars, and Gloria, played by Paula Pell, is excited to finally be celebrated in a gay space for the first time as an out queer woman. Dawn, played by Sarah Bareilles, meanwhile, mistakes her husband's insecure reminder that he and their son love her for pity, and so she starts to spiral about not being able to keep up the posture of deluded confidence necessary to be a pop star. So Summer suggests that she adopt a stage persona as a solution to her problem, and that's clip one.
I just don't think my body's gonna let me do the show.
Wait.
You have to do what pop stars do. Get an alter ego, right? Nicki Minaj has Roman Zelensky, Beyonce, Sasha Fierce,
Ziggy Stardust.
I don't think a cartoon needs an alter ego.
Your knowledge base is so inconsistent.
Summer's right, though. When I have a shy bladder in a public bathroom, I channel a person named Urina X Thunder Force.
I don't know.
Say a cool name. Don't think. Now.
Fledge Mulholland.
Fledge! I need you to look at Fledge. Fledge is fearless. Her husband doesn't have a face, and she could give two F's that everybody is judging her for her stupid name.
Okay, today, today I'm Fledge Mulholland.
Fledge.
Saved the show, guys.
I'm almost positive that's Renee Elise Goldsberry's voice singing Fledge Mulholland in the background, which is like even better. So, anyway, when the group arrives at Y2Gay, Gloria is dismayed to discover that the gays won't give her the time of day, even if she was the very first legal gay divorce in New York State. And instead, they are yes-queening the hell out of Wiki, Renee Elise Goldsberry's character, who clicks all the boxes for gay diva worship. But when a particularly enthusiastic gay named Xander, played by Saturday Night Live's Bowen Yang, expresses devotion for Wiki's performance in the incredibly short-lived Maskicle the Musical Broadway show, Gloria gets suspicious. And when she asks Xander why he would know a decade-old obscure musical, he explains that Wiki was infamously caught on tape melting down at a photographer in the audience. Clip two.
Okay, weird, masky mask. No, stop. I see you. I see you, lady. Cease and desist. When you snap a photo of my performance, you disrespect me. You disrespect the work. You disrespect Sir James Eugene Carey. Cease and desist, bitch!
I should clarify, I think I said Broadway production. This was very much not a Broadway production. This was a regional production that did not last long enough to go anywhere. So Xander explains to Gloria that he is a YouTube lip syncer and he went viral off of lip syncing Wiki's outburst. Gloria spills this to Wiki, and while at first she's thrilled at her own notoriety, she gets irate when she finds out that Xander has been profiting off of her moment and selling merch with her cease and desist catchphrase. Clip three.
You need to cease and desist with cease and desist, bitch.
Wait, I don't. All this is soups above board, actually. See, after I lip-sunked you, I was like, Xander, be a business boy, you know, because my parents are lawyers. Well, you don't know that, but my parents are lawyers. Anyway, I looked the phrase up. It was fully a veil, so I trademarked it.
But these are my words.
That I made into art. Wait, are you not proud of me?
This is theft!
Wiki, I worship you, but what I did took a ton of work. You're the subject. The girl with the pearl earring doesn't get paid. Vermeer gets paid.
Vermeer died penniless. I know this because I watched Jeopardy. How much money did you make, Xander?
You're a queen. You don't need any of my dumb money.
How much?
Between merch and a sponsored post for Weight Anxiety sneakers and the remix. And please remember, NYU is expensive.
A number, Xander.
$80,000. And also, I spent it.
On NYU?
No, girl, I told you, my parents are lawyers. On bags and tattoos. This one says gratitude, and I mean it.
You human B-side!
Please go off. I can make enough to buy a Dairy Queen that I operate as a joke.
So, determined to take their agency back, Wiki and Gloria and the whole Girls 5 Eva group defy the Y2 Gay organizers' demands to play their old stuff and instead perform Four Stars. But with Xander obtrusively filming and provoking Wiki from the audience, she snaps on him, only for Gloria to step in and read Xander the house down boots work tea hunty, employing any number of creative slash belabored catchphrases in clip 4.
5 stars is a lot.
Wait, what
nobody
is this
perfect,
song?
So then what, Diva?
Play your the old stuff.
Freak out my friend so you can sell some t-shirts. Because she's not going to freak out. She's not going to be like, shut it down, clown town. Order in the sport court. Time of death, now. Simon says you got to go to the bus station and get far away from here. Richard Nixon. Okay. You don't get to decide whether we're going to sing new stuff or old stuff, because unlike you, Xander, we have stuff. Wiki, she spent her whole life making stuff, singing, dancing, spokesmodeling for discount whipped creams.
Available everywhere discounted pies are sold.
So after the performance, Wiki and Gloria celebrate backstage, only to be joined, surprise, by Xander, where it's revealed that the whole thing was a stunt designed to help Xander go viral, promote Four Stars for the group, and give Gloria her gay diva moment. And also to let Wiki profit off of the catchphrases Sexy Geppetto and Richard Nixon. Watching this episode the first time, my jaw dropped at how tailored it was to my own particular interests, which I know isn't a reason for you to vote it, but I think it speaks to the episode's specificity and authenticity. Everything about Y2 Gay specifically felt deeply real, starting with the fact that Gloria, who is actually queer but not particularly fabulous, would feel completely invisible in a crowd of 20-something gay men who aren't even old enough to get what the term Y2 Gay is referencing. That's clip 5.
Here we go. I am ready to cut loose.
Girls 5 Eva, I'm the DJ, Ned.
Well, Ned, I am pickled to be here, and I can't wait to inspire the crap out of some queer women.
Women? No. This is a daytime rave in an abandoned mannequin warehouse. The sponsors are vegan condoms and skinny boy vodka.
Guess I sent my dogs to my sisters for nothing. Well, you know what? I am pumped as punch to feel the love from whoever is here.
We love you, Wiki. Cease and desist, bitch.
Wiki, we see you, lady.
I see you too, fellas.
As somebody who may have on occasion have felt invisible in queer spaces, I get this. I feel this. This is real. This episode reminded me of an episode of another show, the other two, the Chase Gets the Gays episode, and how many details the writer nailed about gay pop culture at this moment. You don't necessarily need to know that Wiki's maskical meltdown is referencing a famous Patti LuPone captured video moment where she stopped a performance of Gypsy to harangue a photographer. You don't need to know that Bowen Yang's performance is referencing his own viral Instagram videos where he's lip-synced to scenes from Grey's Anatomy and Aaron Brockovich and The Devil Wears Prada to get why. You don't need to know all that to get why the episode is funny. But as the kids say these days, if you know, you know. And it adds just a whole other layer of, I don't know, feeling seen to this episode. Secondary to this episode's appeal, but I think also important, is the subplot with Dawn and her husband, Scott, who is played by Daniel Breaker. It actually communicates something interesting and valuable, I think, about their relationship, namely that Scott's anxiety over potentially being not interesting enough for his pop star wife is becoming a problem for him. This all starts at the beginning of the episode when Dawn is perusing through some of the artifacts of her girl group days. That is in clip 6.
This is signed by Derek Jeter.
Yeah, we sang the national anthem at Yankee Stadium, and then some of us got a gift basket the next morning for fucking Derek Jeter.
That is so unfair. You don't even like baseball.
Fantastic joke, and an A+, making good use of the fact that you're on Peacock now and you can say fuck. Yep. Very, very good. Scott also has a great scene with a bartender at Y2Gay who is dressed up as Tipper Gore. He's played by comedian Peter Smith, that talks about how the phenomenon of how like tends to find like in celebrity relationships. And, you know, Lisa Bonet is married to Jason Momoa and not like a teacher, at which point Scott says he's a guidance counselor. You know, same difference. That this all leads to Dawn adopting Fledge Mulholland is a great payoff and continues to let Sarah Bareilles reveal a surprising amount of comedic chops in her role, which is one of the great sort of discoveries, I feel like, of Girls 5 Eva. Thirdly, the joke density in this episode is insane. It rivals the best of the Tina Fey, Robert Carlock oeuvre, which is also gets thrown around in this episode, which I enjoy. From a throwaway gag about an October Sky tramp stamp to the fact that Maskicle's signature green cocktail dyed the audience members' anuses green, yeah, to the implication that Tom Green and Drew Barrymore tried to get Dawn into a threesome, it is a packed episode reference-wise. Name another show that's going to drop a joke about a Henrietta Lacks situation and then just motor right along. Bowen Yang's Emmy nomination for his Saturday Night Live performance was richly deserved this year, but he could have justifiably gotten a guest actor nomination here as well, if only for the variety and verve of his cheering-slash-provoking asides to Wiki, my personal faves being "You slay my ass, I have no skin," and "Be perturbed, my sovereign." Finally, speaking of Emmy worthiness, this episode is a great showcase for Renee Elise Goldsberry as Wiki, my favorite performance in the series and probably my favorite comedic performance in any show all year. It's easy to peg Wiki as the Jenna Maroney of the show, and that DNA is definitely present, but I've always found an odd groundedness to her performance among all the sort of insanity that allows her own diva posture to shine through while also fiercely trying to justify it to herself, which I think is really interesting character choice. The episode closes with Wiki, ever the opportunist, going to a lawyer to further trademark any other lucrative catchphrases that she might think up on the spot. It's a throwaway scene, a classic sort of almost before credits scene that nevertheless ties up everything about this episode that is great. Rapid fire jokes, flawlessly delivered, that my gay friends and I will be repeating constantly. Clip 7.
Now, I'm a forward-thinking businesswoman, so I'd like to trademark all future mouth gems. Please take dictation. We may be here for a while. Nothing stickies to Wiki.
Horses clomp, I stomp.
Nuh-uh, Google. Dr. Quinn, medicine weirdo.
Is that anything? Put that down to be safe.
I say sex on the city. And that's a wrap on hot dog.
And with that, I hand my presentation to you, my sovereigns.
Thank you, Joe. Sarah, why don't you start? Because I think Dave and I have watched more of the show than you.
Oh, my God. The joke density is so good. Like, a lot of the lines that I wrote down, you did mention, but like things like mansplaining and like just a running joke with Paula Pell just being like, well, I don't have to be home to relieve my father's nurse until 6. Like, I sent my dogs to my sisters for nothing is just like, oh my God, perfect. And then Bowen Yang just being like, it was a photo when he's trying to video her. I was like, this is such confident writing, and everyone involved is perfectly paired with it, whether it's lead talent or guest stars. It's so good. And Joe, your point that this is a world and a sort of like set of ideas and dialogue with each other that is so well loved and understood by the production, I think makes it funny and sweet and not mean. Sometimes like that, sometimes a super packed joke density without that like fondness, it doesn't always Like, you could sort of respect the pacing, but it doesn't always work. But I definitely responded to this. And like, the songs are good and the lyrics are so funny, like Sinatra or Burger King. It's just like, what? It's like, obviously I will own this album. This was a pleasure to watch. Your presentation was a pleasure to hear. And I think it's sort of typical of this episode that they try to coin the word gag, but then they're just like, yeah, that's probably not going to work. And then they just keep moving like a shark. But oh my God, stop the Mescaco is something that I'm just going to be yelling at pets and they will not understand it, but they don't listen to me anyway. So why not have fun with it? Dave.
I feel like when Joe was describing, you know, how this show came at the right time and its tone and its subject matter and how much we did not like Ted Lasso generally, this, I feel like, is our Ted Lasso, the way Ted Lasso is for everybody else.
Don't implicate Joe in that.
No,
he
might
like Ted Lasso. We don't know.
Us three. Joe loves Ted Lasso. He's the biggest Ted Lasso-er around. I don't really have a lot to add as far as like why this episode is particularly great, because Joe really nailed everything. I just want to say there's some moments, even though this is an audio format, there's one moment, and it's such a like a little small moment, but it really just sold the whole episode for me. And it, of course, has to do with the Mask musical. Just after Renee comes from the flashback, and there's a second and a half after she's remembering all this, she's sort of like really subtly still doing the Jim Carrey dance moves that she was doing while she was. And it's just this like perfect character note that she thought and still thinks that this was like real art.
Yep.
And worthy of everybody's time and her talent. And that really, really sold the episode for me. Like, it is so dense with jokes, but also like these little moments. And I really just adored it. And I'm just going to leave it there because I really can't add anything else.
Okay, well, first I'll say, Joe, I think you apologized too much for this, how soon we got a canon submission for this show, because I believe I presented the Jackie Daytona episode of What We Do in the Shadows like 2 weeks after it aired.
It was airing while you were presenting.
I was typing so fast. Anyway, so I definitely don't think it's too soon. So let's start with Dawn / Fledge. The little shrug she gives when she's in the clip that you cut where she's explaining how she got this autographed Derek Jeter. Yes. She's like, a few of us got them for fucking Derek Jeter. Like, she doesn't, she's like, I could make up something, but I'm not going to. Who cares?
Right.
So great. And the backstory for Fledge, it's like, what is Fledge doing now? She's somewhere driving a Miata, like a Miata. So Fledge got electrocuted in the crotch. So she sits in chairs like this. And
so funny.
In
so
different good. Area codes. Sarah Bareilles is, you know, she has to be the straight woman for most of this. And so she knows exactly what the role is. And she's really great in her lane, because obviously Wiki is the diva and, you know, that she's going to suck up a lot of oxygen, and rightly so. So let's get to her. Yeah. The Henrietta Lacks joke is especially funny. And I thought you were going to say this because Renee Elise Goldsberry played Henrietta Lacks in the HBO movie.
So
it was like, that was a double joke there.
Yes.
And to Sarah's point about how there's a fondness for the characters, is that like the solution to the whole Xander situation is everyone wins. Like that's the end of the meltdown story, is everyone gets exactly what they want out of it, which is lovely, including the audience, because we get to see Xander's final lip sync to Gloria's meltdown over the credits. And thank God.
Yeah.
To your point about the specificity, his gratitude tattoo, I don't know why I remember this except that I wrote it up for Fame Tracker, but at some point Sarah Jessica Parker was interviewed for either Jane or possibly People magazine, and the writer made a point of saying that her, like, you remember when you had flip phones and you could put like a word on your when it was closed, it would be like your signature word or something. Hers was gratitude, like on her fucking Motorola. Like, this made it into a People story.
Oh my God.
Gratitude. It's just so smarmy. And I'm sure whoever wrote this or did not remember this, but I did, and I loved it.
I bet they do. Sex on the City.
Perhaps. Yeah, I was going to say, I'd give a decent shot that that was actually an intentional
that's
reference.
A great
now
point.
That you mention it.
They obviously wanted to call this episode Cease and Desist, Bitch, and I'm sure they were told not to, which is a shame. But Cease and Desist is fine as it is. And to Joe's point about the specificity of it, you brought up Chase Gets the Gaze, which is an incredible episode of the other two. And by the way, if you like Girls 5 Eva, you will really like the other two. If you, yeah, we talked about it when it came out. Joe was here for it. That he was our guest in that episode when it came out in 2019. God, were we ever so young.
I know.
Full of Ramos nip, this podcast.
It's very good. Season two is coming out next week. It'll be dropping on August 26th. So if you never caught the other two because it was on the Comedy Central app and like who fucking even knows how that works, I get it.
Right.
But it's on HBO Max now, so you have no excuse. There's 10 episodes and they are all great. But the other episode that I was thinking of when you were making this presentation and talking about the authenticity of it was the Instagay episode. I used to be fat, but now I have two nieces. So
no, yes.
Please come back and present either of those episodes of the other two, because
a lot of
what you said about this episode also applies to both of those.
Yep.
And what else can we say? This is perfect. Thank you, Joe, for letting us watch it again.
Thank you.
All right. Let's put this to the official vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
This is real pee. I just wanted to get that line in there. It is a yes for me.
Tara?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, of course. And me too. All right, Girls 5 Eva, Season 1, Episode 6, Cease and Desist. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
I just saw who the winner was. It is time for Winner and Loser of the Week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. Korn, both literal and figurative, Field of Dreams, is getting a series adaptation at Peacock from Mike Schur. I am not sure how to feel about this. I thought the actual Field of Dreams game played last week was some bullshit. I don't understand how you make a movie out of it. I gave an entire keynote address at an academic conference about how series television about baseball doesn't work and why. But I guess we'll find out. He's not taking my money, so let's find out what happens in the corn.
And loser of the week?
Well, first I have a sub-winner, this just in via press release. Announced the date for the first installment of Lifetime's movie reboot of Michael Landon's iconic 80s television series, Highway to Heaven.
Oh, wow.
Starring Jill Scott and Barry Watson. Who? Like, why? I mean, I know who both of them are, but like, what? Anyway, coming Saturday, November 6th, so mark your calendars.
Highway back to 7th Heaven?
yeah, I guess.
Hard pass.
But anyway, loser of the week, men behaving badly. First up, Vincent Kartheiser, formerly of Mad Men and Angel. He was apparently the subject of multiple investigations over allegations of his on-set misconduct at Titans. He's just joined it for season 3 playing Scarecrow, but he is not in any of the publicity tour because he was being a dick. And apparently, from what I could glean from the Deadline story, which was like a little bit vague. Yes. It seemed like he didn't do any kind of gross sex stuff. He was just like being a brat, like having verbal outbursts and stuff and making everyone uncomfortable. And like to the point where they had to have a minder for him on the set. So way to be an adult. Ooh,
Jesus.
Vince.
Yeah. The TV reporter, like, Grapevine he has been a, you know, juicy grape on that for a while.
Oh,
like, you've been interviewed today. Good luck.
And unfortunately, a worse story. Horatio Sanz, who has been accused in a new lawsuit of grooming and sexually assaulting a minor fan while he was still a cast member at SNL. And we'll link this in the show notes, but at the Humorism Substack. Newsletter, I guess. I don't know if it's a Substack. At Humorism, we'll link it in the show notes. There's been a story that sort of talks about how this incident has drawn scrutiny to the way the show staffers, cast, and writers like routinely follow the fan sites of teens and contact them or invite them to the set and just do things that are like on the line of inappropriate or worse, as in this Horatio Sanz situation, allegedly. So get your shit together, guys. Damn.
Speaking about getting your shit together, you know what time it is?
Okay, time.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the sixth game time of the season. The scores are Tara with 3, Sarah with 2, Value Guest still looking to get on the board. Today, we're playing Double Date from Rebecca, who earns herself an extra credit topic. She writes, actors get to fall in love with different people every day at work, so it stands to reason that many have shared an on-screen lover. Oh, don't like that phrasing.
Oh, wow.
In this game, we're mapping love interests across the TV universe. We will give you the name of 2 actors from 2 different TV shows, and you name the actor who links them by virtue of having played both their love interests.
Ah.
Make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
If you know the answer, you get 2 points. If you don't, ask for a clue. I'll give you the name of one of the unnamed actor's love interest characters. After that, you get 1 point for a correct answer. Steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah has 2. I have 9. Valued guest Joe has 1 plus the Eric point. So you have a total of 2 steel meals you may use today, Joe, if you wish.
Okay.
Let's throw it to Pinky to see who is going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right, we're going to go Joe, Sarah, Tara. We got 36 questions, 2 equalizer challenge zones worth 4 points apiece. Are we ready to play Double Date?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yes.
Your 2 actors, Joe, are Jane Kaczmarek and Anna Gunn. Who is the actor who played both of their love interests in 2 different shows?
All right, so Jane Kaczmarek from Malcolm in the Middle, Anna Gunn from Breaking Bad, that would be Bryan Cranston as their common...
Correct.
Common lover.
Thank you for showing your work. I would like to see more of
don't
that.
Help,
Sarah D. Bunting. Marisol Nichols and Shando.
Marisol Nichols and Shando. Well, I don't know who Shando was boning on Charmed, so I'm just going to assume that we are talking about Luke Perry in the middle, so I'm going to guess Luke Perry.
Yes. Well sussed out. It is Luke Perry. I believe the other one is Riverdale. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, right. Sure.
Tara.
Yep.
Tony Danza and Joe Morton.
What the hell?
Wow.
Tony Danza. Who did he romance on TV? I don't know anyone other than his Who's the Boss co-star, Judith Light. So I'll just say Judith Light.
Correct.
Okay. Joe Morton was on Transparent.
The politician.
The politician.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Back to Joe. James Franco, everybody's favorite Franco. And Andrew Reynolds.
All right. Andrew Reynolds, let's see, you could go girls. Well, I'm trying to remember who his boyfriend was on Girls. And then there's Black Monday. Franco. Franco on TV is limited to like Freaks and Geeks or that Kennedy assassination show that I didn't watch, which might be the, all right. Reynolds was definitely married to Casey Wilson on Black Monday. So I'm just going to take a wild guess that it's Casey Wilson.
That's what I would have said too.
Incorrect. Any other guesses?
I would have said Busy.
That is the answer, Busy Phillips.
Correct. Oh, of course.
Joe, how Sarah. Could you?
On Girls 5 Eva. Of the actual show that I just presented for the canon. I'm so stupid. God.
Hot after that info nugget, you have Katie Holmes and Ruth Wilson.
Katie Holmes and Ruth Wilson, both on television. First on The True Love, actually. And then I think on... Wait.
Yeah, they dated in real life.
No, I'm just thinking about the... Like, I just went down a, like, British mystery rabbit hole. But it's Josh Jackson.
Correct.
Yeah. Very good.
Tara.
Yeah.
Rob Lowe, Robert Downey Jr.
Oh. Papa. Okay. Robert Downey Jr. hasn't done a lot of TV, so this is probably Ally McBeal. Oh, Calista Flockhart. It's Rob Lowe from Brothers and Sisters and Robert Downey Jr. from Ally McBeal.
That is correct.
Nice.
Back to Joe. Kerry Washington. Kerry Russell.
All right. Kerry Washington. Oh, this is Kerry Washington and Scandal. Kerry Russell and Felicity both were with Scott Foley.
Yes, correct. To Sarah D. Bunting, Christina Hendricks, Sarah Jessica Parker.
Ooh, speaking of gratitude, not in that episode so much, I don't think, but I believe that Christina Hendricks was with John Slattery on Mad Men, and John Slattery was with SJP on Sex in the City.
Correct.
Sex on the City.
on the City.
Alexis Bledel,
mm-hmm.
Mandy Moore.
Okay, ooh. Alexis Bledel and Gilmore Girls and Mandy Moore in This Is Us both had their way with Milo Ventimiglia.
Correct.
Mm, more
decided to make it gross for some reason? I don't know.
A lot of mustard on this over here. Did not care for. All right, back to Joe. Zazie Beetz, Gillian Jacobs.
All right. Zazie Beetz on Atlanta with Donald Glover. I feel like I'm in Clue, like in the billiard room. and then Gillian Jacobs on Community was in a relationship with Donald Glover's character. So that's why I'm going to say Donald Glover.
You are correct. Sarah D. Bunting. Let me know if you need an explanation for this first clue. Andrew Hsu and Jim Belushi.
Oh, barf. This is like my go-to all television is terrible reference for ages. CTS was on According to Jim with Jim Belushi, and Andrew Hsu was on, with CTS on Melrose. So Courtney Thorne-Smith is the answer.
Absolutely. Back to Tara.
Yes.
Lisa Edelstein, Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Oh, man. Oh, Hugh Laurie. Lisa Edelstein had sex with him in House and Julia Louis-Dreyfus on Veep.
Correct. Joe, Will Arnett, Adam Scott.
Will Arnett, Arrested Development, plus any number of very depressing Netflix shows where he played a sad man. Adam Scott. Oh, okay. So Will Arnett on... Yes, I think Arrested Development had a brief thing with Amy Poehler and also Adam Scott on Parks and Rec, Amy Poehler.
Absolutely. Sarah, Michael Cera, Matt Lauria.
I'm not sure I know who Matt Lauria is. Michael Cera. This is... okay,
remember there's Michael's,
hints. Huh?
I'm just reminding everybody that there's hints. It has not come into play.
I mean,
yet.
I'd rather just guess that it's Aaliyah Shawkat.
Anybody want to take a guess at that one?
Wait, to see if Joe's going to steel meal it.
No?
Okay.
No, I don't know it.
All right. Anybody want to take a guess?
Yeah, it's Mae Whitman.
Whitman.
Matt Lauria is from Friday Night Lights.
Oh, that guy.
All right. Take us into our first score break. Portara.
Yeah.
Adrian Palicki.
Yep.
Kristen Dunst.
Kirsten Dunst.
Damn it! Kirsten Dunst.
Adrian Palicki was with Jesse Plemons in Friday Night Lights, and Kirsten Dunst was with him in Fargo and in real life.
Yes, that is correct. Nice. And we'll take us into our first score break. Dave T. Cole not enjoying having to say all these last names. Scores, please start.
Okay, it is super duper close. I have 10 points. Joe and Sarah are tied with 8.
All right, that means you're both in the Grocer Equalizer Challenge Zone.
This could change everything!
All right, so if you get this, we'll be all tied up because you'll split the 4 points.
Yes, and if right, they run the right. card, they'll be
and they'll
ahead.
Be ahead by 2 points.
That's right.
We'll still be tied up, but...
All right. Yeah. Decide amongst yourselves whether you want ye old TV box from the 1880s, the pop culture 2 box, or the thematic 90s box that was created sometime in the mid-aughts.
I'm going to let Joe choose. I will say we've had good luck with the 90s box.
Correct.
All right. Then let's do that. 90s.
All right.
Good luck. Thanks.
With the 90s box, you get additional information because each card is about a particular year. So we'll read the year and the TV question.
All right.
1999, what Comedy Central program humbly claimed to be the most important television show ever? 1999.
That feels like kind of like Daily Show hyperbole, right?
Could also be Colbert Report, but I'm not married to either. Answer. I don't know for sure.
Yeah. I feel like Colbert might have come later than 99. I would probably go with Daily Show, but...
All right, let's... Daily Show.
Correct. Daily Show. Right. Yes. 1999 again. What one-time teen drama ended its 10-year TV run with the marriage of Donna and David?
Sarah...
ER, duh. Just kidding. Beverly Hills, comma, 90210.
Woo!
I don't really understand why one time is in there, but...
Because they weren't teens anymore by the end.
Also, it's the year 2000, but I'm taking the W.
1998. Who went public with his Parkinson's disease only after closing a $100 million syndication deal for his sitcom?
Nice. Michael J. Fox.
Yeah.
All right. You're 3 for 3. So now you're playing for a point Dublin.
All right.
1991.
Uh-oh.
What Saturday Night Live star warned slackers, you'll be living in a van down by the river? Star
Chris Farley.
Correct.
All right.
Two more, Joe.
Let's do this.
1997. What animated doofus was the first to scale Springfield's Mount Murderhorn and leave his wallet there?
I mean, all right. I don't want to get too cute with this. This feels... I think that's the gag at the end of the episode with the wallet. So I think it's Homer Simpson. And doofus would make a whole lot of sense there.
Correct. All right. Last card. 1997. It's another Saturday Night Live question.
Jeez. Okay.
What haunting exotic dancer did Chris Kattan portray on Saturday Night Live?
As Mango.
Mango, and that's the sweep. So they get all the points.
Good work, Joe.
4 points apiece.
Nice.
Thanks for basically getting those extra points for me. I appreciate it.
Well, now Joe and Sarah still tied, but with 12 points, I am way behind with 10.
Dun, dun, dun.
Way behind. All right.
Good job, everybody.
Let's get back to the game. Back to Joe, Vanessa Williams, Melinda Clark.
Vanessa Williams, Melinda Clark. Melinda Clark on ZOC. What's his name? Shoot, the old man. Damn it. Charles Widmore, who was on Ugly Betty with Vanessa Williams. His name is Allendale?
Oh!
Yeah, I got it!
Nice.
Fuck. I was like, something Dale.
Also on Chip Dynasty. Dale.
Yay.
So this is question 17 for Sarah.
Spread Eagle.
Oh, the Spread Eagle.
Griffin Dune.
Dunn.
Griffin Dunn. I'm done with pronouncing names correctly in this game. Jay Duplass.
Griffin Dunn?
Dune.
Dune and Jay Duplass.
The extra N is for extra Dune.
Fuck. Hint.
Rabbi Raquel Fine on Transparent.
Doesn't help. I don't know. Amber Benson. Why not?
Steel meal question.
Steel meal question for Joe.
Is it just for one at this point?
That is correct.
I have two steel meals.
You don't have to meet the next value guest face to face.
Right. That's true. Anna, for one, I'm going to leave it on the table for the moment. Yeah.
But you can say it since you know it.
It's Catherine Hahn.
Catherine Hahn is correct. Yeah. Yes.
Griffin Dunn in I Love Dick.
Yeah, that I don't even know.
I Love Dick.
Oh, I Love Dick. Sure.
And the other is, who was the other actor?
Jay Duplass.
Jay Duplass and Transparent.
That's Transparent, yeah.
Tara.
Yeah.
Tom Cavanaugh.
Mm-hmm.
Ty Burrell.
Oh. Ha. She just saved someone who fainted at Arches. It's Julie Bowen. Tom Cavanaugh was her co-star in Ed and Ty Burrell in Modern Family.
You are correct. And this is question 19. It is for Joe. Ted Danson, Ed O'Neill.
Okay. Also Modern Family. Ed O'Neill's ex-wife on Modern Family is played by Shelley Long.
Right.
That's obviously... Ted Danson on Cheers, so it's Shelley Long.
Boom. Sarah D. Bunting. Stephanie Beatrice. Darcy Carden.
Stephanie Beatriz with a Z. Stephanie, well, I don't know how she pronounces it. I'm just set. That's for Sarah's benefit. Stephanie Beatriz with a Z.
Okay. And Darcy Carden.
In the great American tradition, I'm just saying it like I'm reading it, and that's the name from now on.
That's fine.
Griffin, okay. We're spelling Burrow, B-O. Nothing you can do about it, England.
Okay, so I assume this is a meeting somehow, a crossover of Brooklyn Nine-Nine and The Good Place. I need the hint.
Adrian Pimento on Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That doesn't help me. Ricardo Montalban.
Oh, he's dead. Dead.
So this fantasy island.
We're looking for Jason Mantzoukas.
Jason Mantzoukas.
Not who I thought it was going to be at all.
Yep.
Matthew Morrison, Paul Scheer.
Oh my God. I need the hint, please.
Emma Pillsbury on Glee. Bread in a can? It'll never work, Pillsbury.
Oh my God, what is her fucking name? What is that actress's name? I can picture her. She was also in Heroes. Oh God. Oh, I don't remember her name.
Anybody remember?
It's been so long since I've seen her.
Jemma Mayes.
Yeah.
Mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise.
Yeah.
The inferior to Miracle Whip. Bread Let's spread.
Don't bring this over to
Ellie
this podcast.
Kemper. Joe, Ellie Kemper.
Yes.
Briga Helan.
I don't know who that second person is. Ellie Kemper. So on The Office, there was Ed Helms, and on Kimmy Schmidt, there was some people. I'll take the hint.
Logan Beekman on Kimmy Schmidt.
This is really hard. Logan? I have no idea what this guy's name is. I can picture him, but I don't know the actor's name at all.
Same.
If you can draw me a really good picture, I will also accept that.
I mean, it's probably not the Daniel Radcliffe character from the movie.
Well, let's not forget Joe pulled Alan Dale out of his ass.
I did pull Alan Dale.
He did.
Logan Beekman.
Beekman, yes.
Oh, I think I can picture him too, but I have no idea who it is.
Adam Campbell is his name.
Right. Brigham Helan is from Good News.
Yeah, he was on Harper's Island, too. I remember liking him on Harper's Island. Yeah, he was on. Great News. Yeah.
Right, Great that News. Duh, not Good News.
Back to Sarah. Steve Carell, Paul Rudd.
Oh, right. Okay, I mean, maybe this is Paul Rudd in Wet Hot American Summer and Steve Carell in... I don't know who this is going to be. What is her name? Let me stall by asking for the hint.
Phoebe Buffay on Friends.
Oh, okay. Lisa Kudrow.
Yes, correct.
That's not where I thought it was going.
What's the Carell show with Lisa Kudrow?
Space Force. What's the Paul Rudd show with Lisa Kudrow?
Friends.
Oh.
Friends, Carl.
Remember Friends?
Right.
It's a 90s
I'm telling
comedy.
The Friends.
It involves six people living in very big apartments in New York City.
Jesus.
Starring Gunther.
Right, Gunther. Prayers up for Gunther.
Jacinda Barrett. Connie Britton.
First of all, fuck off. Connie Britton. I only know one Jacinda Barrett TV show other than The Real World.
And what is that?
Do I even know this show? Yeah, I don't. I had it and then it slipped away. Hint.
Eric Taylor on Friday Night Lights.
I should have just said that. It's, oh no. What's his name?
Oh, God.
Kyle Chandler. Jeez. I swear to God, I only got there from the Us Weekly pictorial that we just talked about on Again
God.
With this Patreon.
I mean,
is the Jacinda Barrett show that Florida show where we're not bad people?
Oh, yeah, Bloodlines.
Bloodline.
Yeah. Bloodlines and Friday Night Lights.
Right.
Joe.
Yes.
Lauren Graham, Patricia Heaton.
Okay. Patricia Heaton is never not on television, which is a problem.
It is.
for this game, for me, and also for other reasons. Ray Romano and Lauren Graham. Oh, on Parenthood, Ray Romano. It is Ray Romano.
Nice. I was like, men behaving badly? She was
like... Right, I was always trying to think of, like, what else could they have... Oh, yeah.
The hint is Hank Rizzoli on Parenthood, and I didn't know there was another Rizzoli outside Rizzoli and Isles on
Shout
TV.
Shout out Dan Casino.
There he
Rizzoli
is.
Rizzoli talk.
Sarah, Matthew St. Patrick, Yvonne Strahovski.
Matthew St. Patrick. Okay, well, I don't feel like Yvonne Strahovski owned, what's his name, on Dexter, but maybe I'm wrong about that. I can't pull anyone's name right now. This redhead with three names, they're rebooting this show. I did Crafty for a movie he was on. Man, that's annoying.
That's right.
He was in Cabaret. Yeah. Help me, universe. Hint.
David Fisher and 6 Feet Under.
God damn it, I know that part! Michael C. Hall.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, God, I'm exhausted.
That was a journey. All right, taking us into our second score break, Tara.
Yep.
Lizzie Kaplan.
Yep.
Tina Fey.
Michael Sheen. Lizzie yes. Kaplan on
Gangway for Foot Cycle.
Yep. So correct. He was with Lizzie Kaplan and Masters of Sex and Tina Fey on 30 Rock.
Correct. All right, let's get the scores, please, Charles.
Oh, my God. Fuck. It is so close. Joe has 18. I have 15. Sarah, 14. But this could change everything because she's alone in the Equalizer Challenge Zone.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, do you want ancient, 90s, or pop culture?
Grandpa Bunsey's going to switch it up and go ancient.
All right, ancient. Back to the one-card system, TV box from long ago. Classics. What Alf... sorry, Elf. What Ralph Edwards-hosted show related the life of a guest of honor through the tales of friends, associates, and mentors?
I just can't get Alf out of my head
yeah,
now.
Yeah, sorry.
This Is Your Life?
Yes. Correct.
Nice.
Sitcoms. What is Benson's last name?
Stop it!
Wow.
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
Sarah, you know this.
If you don't get this, I'm not going to give you any more questions.
Oh, shit.
Benson...
I'm trying to send it to you.
It's just out of reach. Silence. Silence. Oh fuck! This has happened before too. I feel like I've had this question and I also got it wrong. I was like, something French.
What? One more hint. It's not Benson. Benson.
I'm aware of that. I accept my punishment, but I don't know. Beauregard.
It is something French.
It is something French.
Dubois!
This has happened before.
All right, so you're out of your double Benson point range, but you still only need two more questions to get
to tie
your
it up,
four.
To tie up with Joe.
Drama. Dubois. Drama! What was, and if you've been paying attention, I have given this answer a couple times in the past 6 months on this show. What was Ba-Ba Black Sheep called when Robert Conrad convinced NBC to give it another chance? They renamed the show when it got renewed from the grave.
Manimal? I don't know.
That is Black Sheep Squadron.
Oh, okay.
Kids and Games.
Stars?
Who has hosted the most game shows? Bud Collier, Bill Cullen, or Wink Martindale?
Oh, poor old Wink Martindale. Middle guy. Second guy, he said.
Bill Cullen?
Yeah.
Yes!
Hey!
Nice!
I need one more!
Stars. What duo left the cast of All in the Family after the 77-78 season stars. So we're looking for the actors' names.
Oh, God. What duo?
Duo, yeah.
Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers?
Boom, there
is. You did it!
Well done.
And just for shits and giggles, what defunct network aired the first Honeymooners skit?
Dumont Network?
Yes, the Dumont Network. Aren't you clever?
Favorite punchline of Dan Rogge, soon to be a guest on the show again.
We are the men of Texaco.
Update scores, please, sir.
Okay, now Joe and Sarah are tied with 18 points, and I am way behind with 15.
All right, everybody has three questions left. Back to Joe, Adrian Lester, and Anthony Anderson.
All right. Adrian Lester, I know who that is, but I can't think of a TV show he was on. I'm going to not take the hint, and I'm just going to say Tracy Ellis Ross.
All right. Correct.
That's what you gotta do. Nice.
Sarah. George Clooney, Josh Charles.
From ER to The Good Wife, it's my favorite and yours,
Juliana
Margulies.
Correct. Tara.
Yes.
Kristen Bell.
Yep.
Kate Nash.
This is Chris Lowell. He romanced Kristen Bell in Veronica Mars and Kate Nash in Glow, much mentioned in this episode.
Very nice pull. And tailored for Tara.
Joe. Tiffany Haddish, Sherry Shepherd.
Ham!
Oh. Well, I don't know the name of the show with Tiffany Haddish, but Sherry Shepherd and Tracy Morgan were on 30 Rock, so I'm going to say Tracy Morgan.
You are correct.
The last OG, right?
That would be my guess. Yeah.
The last OG is correct.
Sarity Bunting, speaking about redheads you love, Kevin McKidd, Jodie Comer.
What? Oh, actually, that is my answer, I think. Sandra Oh, Grey's Anatomy, and Killing Eve.
Nice.
You are correct. Back to Tara.
Yes.
Melora Hardin. Maren Hinkle.
Oh, well, Melora Hardin, I don't think it's anything to do with the bold type.
Melora Hardin or Hardin Melora?
Yeah, I'll take the hint.
Good with Dave.
Abe Weissman on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Abe?
Abe, yeah.
Kevin Pollak? I have no idea who Abe Weissman is.
That's Monk. Tony Shalhoub.
Oh, right. Maisel's her married name. That's why she's a missus. I almost said that and then I didn't.
Joe.
Yes.
Tay Diggs, everybody's Twitter friend, Tay Diggs.
Yes.
Is that him?
True.
Yep.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep.
And Wayne Brady.
Okay. I'm going to thank the years that I spent working at ABC for this one, because the show was passively on in my office for quite a bit. He was on Private Practice and married to Audra McDonald, and Wayne Brady is now currently romancing Audra on The Good Fight, so it's her.
Audra McDonald is correct.
Nice work.
Sarah D. Bunting, Kristen Davis, Marsha Cross.
Oh, it's interesting.
Okay, Kristen Davis could be either Melrose or Sex and the City. And Marsha Cross. Oh, shit. Okay. I'm going to pray that this was Kyle MacLachlan.
All wow! Right.
Nice.
Trey McDougal from Sex and the City. Yes.
And wait, what were you seeing with...
Yeah, what's
oh,
the
he was
Marsha
a later
Cross
husband
one
on Desperate Housewives. That's right.
Oh, right.
I forgot about that.
Tara.
Yep.
This is the last question of regulation. You have Zoe Kravitz.
Yep.
And Alexandra Daddario.
Um, I might as well just shoot the moon because I'm not going to win anyway. So Jake Lacy somehow?
Yes, okay. Correct.
There you go.
Nice.
You mean Chad Lacy?
Oh, was he in High Fidelity show?
High Fidelity, I imagine.
Yeah.
That is regulation like, scores at the end of the game. Please start.
All right. I finished with 19 points. Sarah and Joe, 24 apiece.
Ooh. All right. That means you guys are in the tiebreaker. Tara, take a seat. Chill out. Get a beer. Here we go.
Good luck.
As soon as you know the actor's name, you shout it out. That's how you are going to win.
Got
are
it.
You ready, Joe?
Yes.
Are you ready, Sarah?
Dubois.
Angela Bassett, Rachel Griffiths.
Michael C. Hall. Or not Michael C. Hall, but just fuck.
No, don't say anything else. Sarah gets a guess now.
Damn it. I'm so stupid.
Take your time. Torture Joe.
Yeah, seriously. I have no one to blame but myself. Oh, God.
I appreciate the speed in which Joe wanted to answer and get it in there. That was good gamesmanship.
He did.
But Sarah gets one guess.
Kalsa?
Peter Kalsa! 911 and 6 feet under is correct.
Woo!
Also, I'm really kicking myself for not doing that steal.
Sarah!
I was like, Jeremy Sisto, what? Oh, wait.
Oh, God.
The second tiebreaker I had, just in case, I'll just let you know, is Josh Radnor and Billy Magnuson.
Kristen Milioti.
Correct, yes.
Oh,
How I Met Your Mother and Made for Love.
All right, Peter guys, Krause. That is it for another. Are you okay, Joe?
No,
no.
I won't be for a bit.
And for another episode of Extra Hot Great. Joe, that's why game time is always such a delight when you come on, because you take it you. So seriously.
I do.
You should.
As I should.
We put heels in a half Nelson before going around the dial with stops at Reservation Dogs, Fantasy Island, Big Brother, Animal Kingdom, and What If Ellipses? Question mark. Joe made the successful case for Girls 5 Eva's Cease and Desist for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from Rebecca, tying up the season. Also, there was a rigid air vehicle thing in there in the middle. I emailed him about an hour ago during taping. I have not heard back. I still have no idea what that means. All right. Remember.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Fletch Mulholland,
Sarah D. Bunting,
I finally get empathy,
and Joe Reed.
That's a wrap on hot dogs.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
RuPaul said every month is Pride Month.
Thanks, Rusty.
Stop listening to my private conversations.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.